are as welcome as can be. M-A-R-K-S-H-E-A-A-A. I don't have enough letters in my name to spell that out. But anyway, welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, where we are here today, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And it being Thursday, we are here today with my co-host, Mr. Doug O'Brien. Doug is a... Hello there. He's a partner in public policy consulting, whose clients include businesses and nonprofits working on humanitarian assistance. And before that, he's worked with the Franciscans. That's where I got to know him, out there at Marytown in Chicago, where he lives. And he was the CEO of a leading national food bank. That's going to come into our conversation today a little bit. And he's former political consultant, veteran of several presidential and congressional campaigns, one of which you actually won, right? I mean,
yeah, won.
You know, that was like Toby Ziegler in The West Wing, right? He'd won one thing in his whole life, but it happened to be the president of the United States campaign, so he turned out okay. Anyway, been married for 25 years and got six kids and is just a swell guy. How you doing, Doug?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thank you.
Good. Good. Well, I thought there's lots going on in the news with this week, of course. There's Pneumonia Gate. There was like this weird little thing where somebody came up with this theory that Hillary had a body double. Yeah. I don't know if you saw it. And it was like, and apparently it was the body double who fainted, according to this theory, because of reasons. And it was all like super convoluted, but all I could get out of it was, apparently, the body double got sick and fainted so that people would not know that Hillary actually was in perfect health, which is a weird conspiracy to me. Yeah. And so anyway, there was all that going on. And then there was she gave a speech last week in which she used the now famous line, basket of deplorables, which was not, I thought, terribly felicitous. So there was that whole thing. And then Trump, to my surprise, actually did something that I praised him for this week. Right. He said that mothers should have paid maternity leave for 6 weeks or so. And this is, by the way, at the same time that, you know, there's been lots and lots of alt-right, you know, white supremacist, KKK, you know, zeal and support for him, which is actually what prompted Hillary's speech. And that was like, nah, that's okay, you know. But then he said 6 weeks of paid leave for mothers, and people were like, this is horrible. It's like, this seems like odd priorities, you know. So there was that going on, and there was something that happened I just saw on the news today. I think it was in San Antonio. This woman, her name is Joan Cheever, and she runs something called the Chow Train. And did you see this?
I did.
Yeah, okay. So she runs, you know, the San Antonio, like a lot of towns, has a homeless problem. And homeless people are really weird, because when they lose their homes and wind up sleeping on park benches, it turns out that they still need to eat food.
They do indeed.
Who knew? You know, you would think that they would start to prioritize their needs and just stop needing food so that they could, you know, afford a house. But they go on selfishly needing to eat. And so this woman named Joan Cheever, who's a Catholic, started something called the Chow Train. And so she was out there feeding homeless people. And so the city of San Antonio, in its infinite wisdom, said, that's bad. You must stop doing that. And they slapped her with this big fine for feeding people. And she said with, this is something that the apostles could have said. She said she appealed to the city of San Antonio on religious liberty grounds, which I thought was brilliant.
Yes.
And she said, this is my church, and this is how I pray. And the city of San Antonio backed down and waived the fine. And I thought, that is freaking awesome.
Yep.
So it's interesting because these conflicts keep happening around the U.S. I've seen this a number of times. There was some guy, I think his name was Roy Abbott. He was a 90-year-old guy in, I forget where, I think it was in like Pensacola or something. I'm not sure. It was someplace in Florida. And they slapped him with a fine last year for going out there. And I think he was a Catholic guy, too. I'm not sure. And they tried to slap him with a fine. This 90-year-old guy who's just this holy man who just went out there because people were hungry and they needed something to eat. And he was, like, making sandwiches and taking them out there. And so they tried to hit him with a fine. And I forget what happened with him. But this is something that keeps coming up. There are different cities passing these different ordinances that are treating homeless people like they're squirrels in the park or something. They don't feed the homeless. They're vermin. And the idea is somehow or other that if you stop feeding them, then maybe they'll go away. Maybe they'll just die. But they won't be our problem anymore. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's funny. There's more than 30 cities, actually, that ban the feeding of the homeless. Mm. And so they ban the feeding of the homeless, but then there's also this ongoing problem of when congregations try to open up homeless shelters or a soup kitchen, they face zoning restrictions, oftentimes from people who don't want that in their neighborhood.
Right.
So it really is. It calls for, frankly, you know, a bigger solution. But we need to recognize that churches and people of faith will act upon that faith. And right. This is a big part of their faith.
Right. Absolutely. And if there was ever a place for civil disobedience, this is it.
Absolutely.
Bravo to Joan Cheever. And that was a fantastic reply she gave. And every Christian in the United States and every Christian organization that's dedicated to feeding the homeless really should do this, should make this a religious liberty issue, because it is.
Right.
It really is. This is right. This is as much at the heart of our faith as the Eucharist is. And telling Christian people that they cannot feed the homeless is just like telling Christian people that, sorry, you can't celebrate the Eucharist. It's at that moment you look at Caesar and say, we must obey God rather than men. So, blow it out your ear. I'm going to do this anyway. And if you put me in jail, I'll go to jail. And as soon as I'm out, I'm going to do it again.
Right. It's like the Pope Francis quote, which is, you pray for the hungry, then you feed them. That's how you feed
them. Right. That's how it's done, you know.
Prayer and action, my friend.
Prayer and action. Yeah, ora et labora, as the Benedictines say.
Yep.
And so anyway, I think that Joan Cheever, I hope that she sparks a little fire here across the U.S. And I hope every Christian imitates her and says, this is my church and this is how I pray. Because that's what it is. So bravo to her. I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about, there is a legitimate question that came up this week, you know, and so Hillary went to a 9/11 memorial this last week, and she's been coughing and looking sick. I've seen some speeches of her, and she didn't sound so great. Then she went to this 9/11 memorial, and it was like hot and crowded and everything. And she did, I think, what I would do under those circumstances, which is she almost fainted. And so they had to come and, you know, get the car, and somebody took a cell cam shot of her getting loaded into a car. And it was very clear that she had, collapsed for a minute, and they sort of had to bundle her in the car. And so naturally questions arise. How sick is she? Is it the business of the voting public, to know about the health of a candidate? And those are, I think, legitimate questions. Because we have had, in fact, presidents who had very dire health issues that were kept from us. So, you know, Woodrow Wilson's wife basically ran the country for the last few months of his administration because he'd had a massive stroke and he was not competent to function as president. So she did everything. And nobody knew about that at the time. And those were back in the good old days when you could have a president who was severely debilitated and it didn't make that much of a difference. But these days, you know, nuclear launch codes and all those sorts of things really do kind of suggest that we need a better way of evaluating things like that. And, of course, you know, we've had presidents who were debilitated by illness in a certain sense, and yet who, of course, functioned perfectly well. The absolute classic case in point of this is FDR, a guy with polio who became president and is, I think, arguably the greatest president of the 20th century. So we'll continue talking about this when we return. The whole issue of health and the presidency. We'll be back with Doug O'Brien right after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Doug O'Brien. And Doug, we're going to move on in a little bit and talk about the whole question of, you know, how do we as voters in a free society, how do we evaluate questions like the health of candidates? Because it really does enter into, it's a legitimate question to discuss. But before we do that, I wanted to circle back because, Doug, you were saying during the break that you've worked with Feeding the Homeless organizations, and you've encountered these kinds of issues. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, the whole issue of, you know, kind of the not in my backyard.
Right, sure.
Hostility to the homeless.
Well, I mean, one of the situations that I was reminded of while you were talking was when I was at Feeding America. At the time, it was called America Second Harvest. Our food bank, the food banks that organization operate all across the country in rural and suburban and city communities. And it was not uncommon. In fact, it became more common in the early 2000s, in which small churches and congregations would try and open up a soup kitchen. The one that came to mind was, I believe it was in Richmond, Virginia, in which a Presbyterian church wanted to open up a soup kitchen on the church's own grounds. And they faced zoning issues from the city council and then also opposition from the neighbors. And in the end, we had to, at the bequest of the food bank, sought out a national law firm who, with pro bono assistance, helped us in that case. In the end, people backed down. And the issue of religious liberty wasn't kind of the hot topic it is right now, right? So I'm not sure those arguments were made. But in the end, you know, there is this issue of, like you said, not in my backyard. And yet you have, you know, even my parish, which is in a semi-rural area, has a food pantry. And you could see this trend in which people say, you know, we don't want poor people coming here and picking up food, and we certainly don't want the homeless here, you know, every day or every three times a week at a soup kitchen. But those situations happen. And as I said, according to Huffington Post, more than 30 cities have bans against feeding homeless people. So it is a problem. And it does, yeah, I think, at some level, rise to a religious liberty question.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it really does. You know, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. It's right there at the heart of the gospel. And there are things that we really can't compromise on. It's not, the gospel is not only concerned with cultic practices.
Right.
You know, we would be very, very upset, and rightly so, if the state marched into the sanctuary. And the state didn't even try this during Prohibition, right? I mean, there were, one of the things that happened during Prohibition was there were, of course, special religious exemptions for Catholics. So you could go out there and you could get your sacramental wine for use during Mass. If you were Jewish, you could get, you know, your wine that you were going to need to celebrate Passover or whatever Jewish rites and so on and so forth. The state made exceptions for that. And if the state marched into the sanctuary, as it has done in other countries and other times, and started smashing up the altar and setting fire to the Eucharist and dumping the consecrated host on the ground, everybody would recognize that that is a gross infringement of religious liberty. But the church doesn't just exist in the sanctuary; it exists outside the sanctuary. It exists in our persons as lay people. And when we go out into the world, we have certain obligations. And one of them is when you see the hungry, you feed them. And if we're barred from doing that, that's there's no difference in terms of infringement of religious liberty. And so we have an absolute obligation to fight the state on that if the state tries to get in the way of us doing that. Now, the state's got a legitimate interest in seeing that we do it right. So, you know, the state does have the right to say that, you know, look, Typhoid Mary, I understand that you're a devout Catholic, but we don't want you making sandwiches, you know, and feed them to people because they'll get typhus from you. Go ahead.
What I was going to say, Mark, though, is that, you know, we're talking about a subject, though, that a sub-issue that we can all agree on as Catholics and Christians generally and people of goodwill generally, right, that when someone's hungry, we should feed them. But the religious liberty issue, you know, just a few days ago, Archbishop Laurie had to essentially write a rebuke to the commissioner of the Civil Rights Commission who – was advocating that some religious groups are on the fringe, and I would argue that you know, it can be good things like this, but religious liberty is kind of a big net that
right,
is cast for good reason.
Right, right. Yeah, and you know, that's one of those points of tension. So, somebody once said, I thought this was really well put. I forget who it was, somebody who was involved in sort of the church's activities of, you know, social action and healing and so on and so forth, was asked, why do you give medical care to Muslims and atheists? And he says, and his reply I thought was brilliant. He says, we don't serve people because they're Catholic. We serve people because we're Catholic.
We're Catholic, right?
Right. Right. Exactly. And so that's really that is really the case. You will get, of course, you're going to get people who will make religious liberty claims that are bunk.
Right.
I belong to the white identitarian church of Hayden Lake, Iowa, you know, or Idaho. There actually is a Hayden Lake, Idaho, and it really does have neo-Nazis there, or at least it did. And they, you know, they claim to be a church. Well, the state has you can have your free association group of people who just want to sit around and brag about their white skin. Fine, whatever. You know, knock yourself out. You can sit in your mom's basement and do those weird things. when that group leaves the sanctuary and starts going into the outer world and starts hurting other people in the name of their religious ideology, that's when the problem begins. And of course, you know, the question then is, what do we mean by hurt and what constitutes hurt and those kinds of things? But none of that really pertains to the question of feeding people. If somebody goes out there and says, are you hungry? Okay, then you qualify for food. No crime is being committed there by any stretch of the imagination. And if the only issue is paperwork, we're going to stop you because we need paperwork of some kind. It's at that point that the church has an obligation to say the law was made for man, not man for the law. And you can't stop us from doing this. This is too important. This person is hungry. I liked then. That's why I thought Joan Cheever's reply was so brilliant. This is my church, and this is how I pray. There's hardly a more beautiful expression of Catholic piety in the public square than that.
Exactly.
So fantastic. Moving on. Want to talk a little bit about this whole question of what do we as citizens do when we're confronted with questions of the health of a candidate? Because it's a real legitimate question. JFK, for example, was sick as a dog and full of chemicals. For example, when he was negotiating with the Soviets on at least one occasion, and we weren't told that at the time, and it's always, of course, going to be like pulling teeth because on the one hand, the public has a right to know, but on the other hand, the presidency and just a human being's personal privacy come into conflict at that point. And I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on this, because it's one of those questions that kind of stymies me. On the one hand, I don't really want to know all that much about the results of Hillary's gynecology exam, unless she's got cancer, then it's kind of important, you know?
Typical of you, Shay, going right to the pelvic region again, I'll tell you.
Well, there it is. There's all kinds of super private things that aren't really, it's not important for the public to know those things, but there are things that are going to impinge on the presidency sometimes. So cancer, kind of important. This, by the way, there was a show on about 10 years ago called The West Wing about the presidency. And kind of the starting... One of the starting premises of the show, practically, it was revealed in the second season, is the president has multiple sclerosis. Well, that's kind of important, you know, and they lie about it. They keep it hidden. And it's one of the issues that comes up. So I'm curious what you think about, what's appropriate and what's not in terms of knowing about a candidate's or a president's health.
Well, I think there are actually two kind of tactical things that are applied. Is it one, I think, that when you run for president... You did that on purpose.
I didn't really want it, no. I just wanted you to feel like I wanted to. Well, we will continue with this. Listen to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And this is... We're with Doug O'Brien today, and we're talking about the health of the presidency. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Doug O'Brien. Just before the break, where I led you, you know, to believe that I was going to actually listen to what you had to say before I cut you off with the music. You were going to say, you were going to talk about how you as a voter look at issues like, you know, the health of a candidate. It's a pretty right. important subject, but on the other hand, you don't want to know too much.
I was just going to say is I think there's like kind of two issues, and then I think maybe a third that would be unique to Catholics. And the first one is that I think Americans, when you run for the presidency, you essentially are choosing to give up some privacy, right? And Donald Trump should consider this, but your tax records should be subject to scrutiny. That, you know, regular citizens are not subject to that from right. of the public. Your health records, any, you know, civil or criminal actions, those things, just like your position on, you know, any issue, should be subject to public scrutiny. Within reason, and I think that's where it gets gray. I would say secondarily is that part of the reason that has become such a mantra or part of the political dialogue is because, frankly, is that one camp wants to use it against the other camp, and that's why that has life, even though we won't really discuss the privacy concerns. But I think as a Catholic though, and I would just say looking at history as well, is that. And me being the typical, you know, stereotypical Irish Catholic, I do have a picture of John Kennedy above my desk, and he's looking down at me right now. And I would say that despite his physical ailments, or Woodrow Wilson's, or Franklin Roosevelt's, or right. any number of presidents, is that they are able to do their job. And that gets, I think, at the heart of how we Catholics look at people and individuals generally,
right.
is that they will all, we all will have crosses to bear. And the right. question is, can you bear those while doing your job? And I, you know, as opposed to eliminating them because they're disabled or somehow dysfunctional. And I would say that John Kennedy, despite some maybe personal issues, moral issues, as a president, I'm very supportive of. Right.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, at least tried to lead the country in a manner that I think we would all find acceptable and
right, right.
So I guess I kind of don't care that Donald Trump is, as the press reports say, overweight, or that Hillary had a concussion or had pneumonia now. I don't think it really impacts their ability to do their job unless it impacts their ability to do their job. And
right.
You know, for me, the more fascinating thing was that, adding again to the carnival atmosphere of this election, was that Hillary releases her health records publicly, and the New York Times, I guess, got the first bite at them. Donald Trump releases his on an afternoon talk show. it's
something called Dr. Oz.
Dr. Oz. I mean,
it's never seen Dr. Oz. I don't know anything about Dr. Oz.
I don't either. I just know him from reputation. And I would just say that, again, it's just, this has become, you know, the great American electoral freak show. But with that said, Reagan's ailments, other presidents' ailments, as long as they can do their job, I think I really don't care. And I think much scrutiny beyond that is just fodder for enemies and nothing more.
Yeah. You know, I've always thought that it was, I mean, one of the sort of poetic bits of divine justice at work in the great face-off between the civilized world and Nazi Germany. You had this regime that was obsessed with physical health, that gassed people that were not deemed to be lives worthy of living.
Right.
Versus a country that was led by a guy with polio.
In a wheelchair.
Was confined to a wheelchair, and he kicked their ass. You know?
That's exactly right. Right.
And toward the end, you know, I mean, it was a lot more than polio. He had just sky high blood pressure, you know, he was the picture of like how not to treat your body, right? Smoked right. heavily, drank all the time, you know, ate, I'm sure, bad food like everybody else did, and, you know, all the rest of it, you know, and yet, It's magnificent and just sort of divine poetry that in the contest between this, you know, this health obsessed murder regime and the U.S. and led by a guy with polio. It was the guy with polio who just who not only just smashed Hitler, but also, you know, went on. He basically laid the groundwork for this, you know, massive, you know, next 20 years of, you know, prosperity for the U.S. and the rest of the West. And, you know, bully for him. So, and he did it all with polio. So, yeah, the idea, I think today it would be impossible for FDR to win simply because he had polio. We would say he can't do it. It's not possible. Because we do have this bigotry against people
with illness or disability. Yes.
With illness or disability, you know.
Right.
Just yesterday, there was a story out of, I forget where it was, but essentially a woman was given, was it the Netherlands, I'm not sure where it was, but had a young daughter who was severely disabled. And she appealed to a judge for the right to starve her to death. There was nothing wrong with her, except she was disabled.
Right.
And she did it. And so she successfully murdered her daughter. And this a disability group, you know, condemned it as highly inappropriate. Which That's I think is like the weakest.
Yeah.
My response is it was murder in the first degree, you know? Exactly.
State-sanctioned, right.
State-sanctioned murder in the first degree, and there was nothing wrong with that girl except for her disability. She wasn't sick. She wasn't dying. She was a little girl, and if you'd let her live, she would have grown up to be a disabled woman. But the only thing, the only problem with her was she was inconvenient. And
and her utility to society was minimized. Yeah. That's the creeping evil of our age.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, so you look at things like this and think, you know, yeah, where are we going? So that's why, you know, when it's because we obsess about these kinds of things, you know, that when Hillary has a fainting spell, everybody's like, is she fit to be president? Well, you know, I've had fainting spells, you know, because I was dehydrated, or you know, you stand up too fast.
Yeah, everybody's done that. But did you faint and fall on the button though?
No, I did not. It's true. She might pass out and accidentally launch nuclear weapons. That's so true. That could really happen. But yeah, so you know, stuff like that. Yeah, and it makes it difficult, partly because we got this, you know, infinite rush of information coming at us over the internet, and it's given us the attention span of fruit flies.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the good news is next week people will be saying, what fainting spell?
Right.
You know, what pneumonia? You know?
But they'll be looking for the body double.
They'll be looking for the body double.
Yeah, I missed that story. I'm more fascinated by that.
The body double thing is just, yeah. Well, yeah, it's a subculture that spends a lot of time looking for excuses for its failures. And so one of the ways that it comes up with that is conspiracy theories.
Conspiracies, right.
So somebody once told me that conspiracy theories are history for stupid people. And to be fair, I mean, there really have been conspiracies, but the mark of a real conspiracy always is that it very quickly gets exposed and unraveled, because the more people that are involved in a conspiracy, the quicker it is that one of them is going to run for a lawyer when things start to come apart.
Yeah.
So we know, for example, Watergate was a conspiracy, but guess what? It fell apart. The Holocaust was an open secret. People knew what was going on. So it was a conspiracy, but it wasn't much of a secret. And, you know, there have been other kinds of conspiracies. But the idea that there's some globe-spanning massive conspiracy right now to hide Hillary's body double. That's not happening. That's not a real thing. There was no body double for Sister Lucia either. That didn't happen. Not a real thing. Anyway, I'm also one of those people that says that Lee Harvey Oswald was a guy who got up in a tall building and shot President Kennedy, and that's all there is to it.
I agree.
That's too simplistic. So. So let's see. Well, what else is going on? Oh, well, I wanted to. It's not really a big secret that I'm a huge opponent of Donald Trump. And I'm often told by people, well, you just hate him, and that's why. And so he can never do anything right. On the contrary, he can do things right. He did something right. He proposed that new mothers should have 6 weeks of paid vacation. That, yep. Good for him. You know? I don't have any, I got nothing against that at all. I think that that's a great idea, and I commend him for it. And I want to talk a little bit about that idea and similar ideas when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien, and we'll be back right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Doug O'Brien. And I'm going to depart from what I normally have done in the past. We were talking about this just before the break, and say, bravo, Donald Trump. And I'm not being ironic or snarky or sarcastic. I really mean it. He said that it would be a good idea if new mothers had 6 weeks paid leave. And bravo. I agree. That's a great idea. We talk on the right. I've always considered myself somebody who lives on the right. We talk about being pro-family. One of the things that families need is, especially young families, they need help. And it's really hard, to very often and more, younger families especially, mom and dad have to work. We should live in a civilized country. We should live in a country where both parents can work if they want to, but only one need work because the other one can stay home with the children. And that's almost impossible now for young families. And mom can't take any time off to be with her brand new baby, to bond with the baby and do all the rest. She's got to get back to work. And so civilized countries, if they can't see to it that a family can survive on the wages of one parent, they should at least provide paid leave for a new mom for, minimum of 6 weeks. Hillary's got a plan that's, as I understand, is even more generous than that. But I commended Trump for urging this. And it's interesting because the response is twofold that I've gotten. One, I've gotten from Hillary supporters who say, bah! Why are you commending Trump for this? You're giving aid and comfort to the enemy. You should only talk about how evil Donald Trump is at all times. So I get that. The other thing I get, of course, ironically, is from people in Trump's own party who can look at Trump's dalliances with the alt-right, with white supremacists, his love of retweeting white supremacists and neo-Nazi sites and links and all the rest of it. They look at that and go, what's the big deal? It's not a problem. But when Trump briefly attempts to strike out generous fire from the flinty hearts of libertarians and say, maybe if we thought about new families for just like 6 weeks or so, the response is, this is just liberal BS, right? The next thing you know, we'll be communists if we do this. And it's like, okay, this is oddly ordered priorities. go ahead.
But on a serious note, I mean, I think this is really the role in this electoral season is that, and even when there's not an election pending, is that we as devout followers of Jesus Christ need to really work within the party system, whatever the party is or is independents, to make those parties more reflect our values, right?
Yes.
And those values are, I don't mean kind of the parochial dogmatic thing, but I think more the idea of, you know, Matthew 25, the Beatitudes, this notion that we care for the poor, the vulnerable, for families. And I think that, like you said, Donald Trump should be commended for this. I think, yeah, you know, my party has put forward pretty good family leave policies, but it's failing miserably when it comes to the right to life. And I think, yes, that people like myself need to push my party, and Republicans should continue to push their party and should take this victory in hand and hold it dearly.
Yeah, it's a funny dynamic, and it happens on both sides.
Yep.
So what I've found repeatedly, I mentioned it today. So Trump says family leave for paid maternity leave. This is a good idea. It's a good thing. You want to encourage this from Republicans. And what I got from Democrats when he proposed this was, if you grant that this is a good thing, then you're giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And so it's more important to fight against Trump doing this. Even though it's a good thing, it's more important to fight against it because we hate Trump and we want to stop him. And I've seen exactly the same thing from conservative pro-lifers when it yep. comes to Democrats for Life.
Yep.
So Democrats for Life are trying to work within the Democratic Party to say, why are we so insane on this abortion thing? What is it? 1/3 of Democrats, 2/3 of Democrats are opposed to abortion. I forget.
One third, 30 million.
Yeah. Okay. 1/3 of Democrats are opposed. 30 million Democrats are opposed to abortion. And conservative pro-lifers do the same thing that my Democratic friend was doing today about Trump's maternity leave plan. They say, the Democrats for Life are our enemies. We have to defeat them, because if the Democratic Party does become more open to the pro-life position, then our party will lose. They'll lose votes to Democrats. And so it's more important that we protect our party's turf than it is that we make common cause with those people over there who agree with us on the need to end abortion. That's crazy.
Right. And I would say that shows that many of those people that hold those positions are more wedded to their political beliefs than they are to their Christian ethos.
Yeah.
And I think that says a lot. And I think, again, you know, I want all the major parties and minor parties to be pro-life and
right. Yes.
And pro-family and all the above. You know, I can understand there'll be debates on other issues, the pelvic issues, as you call them, you mm-hmm. know, related to gay marriage and transgender bathrooms and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
In which, you know, we may hopefully gently and civilly disagree. But on this subject, you know, Trump should get points. And now let's work on the Democrats to become more pro-life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You keep hoping that will happen, because there are those, you know, those guys in the party. There are those guys. There's guys like you. And it's exasperating to watch how the party dynamics work against the gospel itself, and work to sort of kill the yeast before it can make the bread rise, you know?
Right.
And that reminds me, by the way, that is our task in the world, is to be that yeast. I was talking to somebody the other day who is watching as her very tightly knit all Catholic community. It's I've seen this happen in the past. These sort of lay attempts to create a pure Catholic community. I don't know if you've ever seen these things done, but they happen sometimes.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that succeed. I see it when religious communities begin, where you get like a Benedictine order or these kinds of things. But lay attempts at forming, like we're going to make this town just nothing but us Catholics kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It always fails. It always ends in catastrophe. I've never seen it work. And I remarked to a friend of mine the other day as we were talking about this, I said that bread made of nothing but yeast is just not good bread. And that's...
No, it's kinda, beer.
It's beer. That's true. Well, and even beer isn't just yeast. I mean, it's other things. But that's really interesting, is that for us, there seems to be in the Catholic tradition, there's room in the Catholic tradition for religious orders that are devoted to a particular charism. But when it comes to us laity, God just doesn't seem to have ordained that we, just as laity, can just start up just, you know, sort of lay towns or create, you know, these sort of enclaves where it's just us laity huddled up together in a kind of a fortress, keeping the world out. God seems to insist that we laity get kneaded into the bread of the world as yeast and function in that way. Because I've simply have never seen it work. I've never seen these lay communities work.
Think of the history of the early church. I mean, the first Christians were the leaven in a very corrupt, pagan, and brutal society, right? And it was actually by living out as Christians that they won converts. And
right.
Preaching played a role, but a much bigger role was how they, according to contemporary contemporary reports, is that it's how they cared for the sick, the poor, how they loved one another. I mean, that really is, to me, the model that we need to go forward in, you know, in 21st century American politics the same way.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, and I think that we can do that because it's been done before. One of the nice things about being Catholic is that you've got this big, long heritage, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know?
Right.
You just say, I think I'll try what those guys did because I'm too dumb to think up anything new. So, Doug O'Brien, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Mark.
A pleasure. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Jen the Jawa Longworth. And we will be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.